Thanks for coming, everybody. A sentiment that is shared by a lot of people when they come to church on Sunday is really, I think, well reflected in this Dennis the Menace cartoon. So Dennis is coming out of the service with his parents, and he looks up at the pastor and he says, "Great sermon, Pastor." But that's not the sentiment that most of you share. This one you do agree with, though, I'm sure. My dad said hallelujah when it was over. It's especially true. I hear that a lot when Dan's done, so. I don't know how many of you saw this news story this last week, but it was one of my favorite ones of 2014. So this lady, Elizabeth Sullivan, she's 104 years old. How many of you saw the news story about her? Amazing, amazing. I mean, talk about, she's got more energy than I do. And in large part, if you saw this story, you know what she attributed her health to. It's Dr. Pepper. And of course, Dr. Pepper was really smart, and they figured out how to capitalize on this, but this story goes, in essence, it says 104-year-old Elizabeth Sullivan, who told CNN this week that she's been drinking 3 Dr. Peppers a day for decades, and it sounds like for the last 40 years she's been doing it, and that she's never been to the hospital unless it's to give birth or have her tonsils removed. And that's not all. In one of history's great drop-of-the-mic moments, Sullivan boasts to CNN that she's had 2 doctors who have told me that I drink, that if I drink it, I will die. But they died first. You come to church and you get your health tips, right? Dr. Pepper, I guess. Someone says it's got to be the prune juice in there. This is an unexpected story, isn't it? Right? Yeah. It's not the result you would expect from someone who drinks 3 cans of Dr. Pepper for 40 years in their life. And this morning, we're going to talk about what I think is among the most unexpected stories in the Bible. And it's where Jesus, it's his only recorded act of physical violence. And he goes at it. And a lot of people want to downplay this and say that he made a whip and that, you know, he was just using it to scare people. But when you make a whip and you have the intention of driving people out, there's a good chance that if you're in his way, you're going to get hit with the whip. And this is the only recorded act of violence. And it's interesting because some people go, well, how can you really trust that that happened? Well, in the stories about Jesus' life in the Bible, and there's 4 of them written by 4 different authors that sort of recount who he was, what he did, and where he went. And this event is recorded in all 4 of the stories. It's a really rare one that is recorded in each one of the 4. Now, Bruce, when he was up here this morning, I think he expressed the sentiment that we all love about Jesus so well. When Bruce was praying, he said, you know, Jesus, when he was on the cross, said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And of course, the stories that draw us to Jesus are the stories about his grace and his mercy and his love and his tenderness and how he extends himself, goes out of his way to extend himself for people that otherwise other people leave by the wayside. And Jesus seems like this guy who always has time for the down and out, and we love that about him. But there is another side of who Jesus was and what he was all about, and that is in this moment he displays for us God's wrath and his demand that those who do injustice, there's a payment for them, for people that don't take God seriously. This is one of those rare pictures of his wrath being poured out. It's interesting because this does come, normally the week before Easter, we do a Palm Sunday message. And Palm Sunday is the event that just immediately precedes this, where Jesus traveling up from Bethany, and it's about 2.5 miles from Bethany. He's staying at his friend's house, Lazarus and Martha, and he's coming over the hill and down into Jerusalem, and probably estimates are that there were as many as 200,000 people, because this was the pilgrimage season where people swelled to Jerusalem for the Passover. And there could have been as many as 200,000 people that were there greeting him, yelling and screaming with excitement, believing that Jesus had come to deliver them from the Romans and the Roman oppression. And this is immediately following that when he enters into the temple. And it's the Matthew account goes like this. It says, Jesus entered the temple courts, and he drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. It is written, he said to them, my house will be called a house of prayer, but you've made it into a den of robbers. And then Luke says, immediately following this, Luke says, every day he was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him because they were the ones that were sanctioning what was going on in the temple. And so they're not happy that Jesus has confronted them. If you open up your notes here, I've got a map in the very front of your notes in there to kind of give you a picture of what the temple was like. And I want to give you just a little bit of orientation about what was going on here. So if you go to Jerusalem today, you can go, and there's a number of museums that have illustrations or pictures. And one of them is this great big model that they have in one of the museums of what the temple looked like. And believe it or not, from a whole bunch of antiquity sources, we have a really good idea. Not only we know exactly where the temple was in Jerusalem, but we also have a really good idea of the dimensions of it and actually what it looked like if you were there. Now, this is a model of what it would have looked like at the time of Jesus, it was much smaller than this just prior. You know, if you went back 100 years before Jesus, it was only about a third of this size. But the grandeur that made it the temple what it was at the time was as a result of Herod, who came in, and Herod trying to curry favor with the Jewish constituents that were living in the town. He took on a number of building projects. His building projects, he's got five of them that were, every one of them is more magnificent than the other. And a couple of years ago, we talked about all those different projects that Herod undertook. He was incredible, the amount of time and energy that he put into building this place. But it was called Herod's Temple because he was the one who expanded it and sort of turned it into the grandeur, the incredible place that it became known for. It's obviously not in Jerusalem anymore. But a number of the limestone pieces that were a part of the temple, or the temple structure, are still there. And you can go to a number of different spots and see them, and you can see how big they were. You can see carvings and engravings that they had on them in a number of different places. It's pretty impressive from what I hear to see the different sites. So if you're looking at the city of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, this is what it would have looked like. And obviously it was on top of a mountain and on a walled city, which everywhere in the ancient Near East, if you had a big city that would host as many people as lived in Jerusalem, there were probably somewhere in the neighborhood of between 20 and 45,000 people that were full-time residents in the city at the time. And of course, because of raiders and invasion, you had to have walls around your city, and that's also why you wanted to be up high. But you can see in this picture, look how much of the city the temple takes up. I mean, it's enormous in what was at the time an enormous city. It was really quite something. And I'll point out to you, if you look to the top right-hand corner, and those of you that kind of have read the Bible and you know the story about Jesus, you know that place called the Mount of Olives or the Garden of Gethsemane? It is just right outside the east gate of the temple there. And that's where Jesus was arrested the night before he was crucified. And the Mount of Olives is where probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30,000 people would camp on the olive groves in that area because the city could not handle the influx of people that were coming into the city to celebrate their Passover festival. It was incredible. The city would inside the city walls, they had about 120,000 people. I mean, it was packed wall to wall, and that still wasn't enough to take all the people that would come for Passover. So people would stay all over the place, and the Mount of Olives is one of those places. Now, if you went out over the Mount of Olives and down, it was about a two-mile journey between the temple and Bethany, which is the town where Jesus was staying with some of his friends. So Jesus would journey back and forth that 2 miles between Bethany and the temple during that last week of his life, and that would be the route that he would take. Now, the reason this is important is because we're going to talk about those events of Jesus driving out the people in the temple, because if you look at the temple, on the right-hand side of there's two courtyards, one on the left and one on the right, and the one on the right, where Jesus would have come in on the east gate, That was called the court of the Gentiles, and that's where all this money changing and selling was going on. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a minute here. So that gives you a little bit of an orientation. And if you kind of zoomed in and looked at what the temple actually looked like, so from here, the east gate would have been the bottom right-hand gate there, and that would have led out to the Mount of Olives where Jesus comes into the city, went back and forth. And so that courtyard on the left-hand side there is the court of the Gentiles where those events that we read about take place. So to give you an idea of how big this is, I mean, what are we talking about? So that red circle is around an area called the court of the women, and it's inside the temple. And it was about the size of a football field and a half. So it gives you a little picture of how big the area actually was. Now, the plot of ground that the temple area actually took up was 36 acres. So, I mean, it was an enormous facility that could handle thousands and thousands and thousands of people at a time. It was just absolutely incredible. Now, Josephus, who is a historian who lived just after the time of Jesus and was around before the destruction of the temple, he marveled at it, and he was a well-traveled man, and he said its structure, the stoa, which was an archway that was built about 150 feet up in the air, which was a kind of a marvel, architectural marvel at the time. He said it was, looking at that part of the structure, he said it was more noteworthy than anything under the sun. The height of the portico was so great that if anyone looked down from its rooftop, he would become dizzy, which is interesting because you know the story where the devil in Matthew chapter 4, Jesus is in the wilderness, and it says that the devil took him up to the highest point of the temple, and you really could. You'd have an incredible view from there, and it makes sense then when he says, throw yourself down. You could see from up there, you could see everywhere, and the devil says to him, throw yourself down because the angels will come and protect you. And Jesus says to him, it's also written, don't put the Lord your God to the test. An enormous facility, and it was big, 230 feet tall at the highest point, which was an architectural marvel for sure at the time to be able to build stuff like this. Herod employed 10,000 skilled workers, and because the temple had some places where very, very few people, only like the high priest, could go into, they sort of had this problem. Well, how do you make a sacred place that only a few people can go in and just have just anybody doing the work? So what they did is they trained about 1,000 priests to be masons to be able to do the work that was required to build the sanctuary area where no one else was allowed to go into. The grandeur of the temple was sort of like the coolest thing they had. And the disciples, I love this passage in Luke chapter 21 where it says, some of the disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and gifts dedicated to God. They were proud of it. Now, this happens after Jesus goes in there and drives everybody out. But they were, and rightfully so, they were really proud of their building, their temple. And Jesus says to them something that had to be unbelievable to them at the time. He says, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. And it's true. The only thing left of the temple today is the Wailing Wall, which was a supporting wall of the temple. In fact, not long after the death of Jesus, 40 years later, Jesus said, because of the corruption that happens here, in a place that is supposed to be reserved for the worship of God, and because you don't take that seriously, God's not going to put up with it. And an end, even of this beautiful place, is going to come. And the Romans came in the year 6970 and laid siege to the city and killed somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 80,000 people that lived in the city and did not leave anything left of the temple. All the gold that was, apparently people said that if you were there and the sunrise in the morning was incredible because of the temple pillars and the towers were plated with gold, and it was supposed to be just an incredible, blinding, beautiful sight to see the sunrise and see the reflection off the towers. And it would all, every piece of it, all the valuables would be taken away. So Jesus comes in, and you have to you wonder, well, what's the big deal about what's going on? I mean, the Bible in the Old Testament prescribes the changing of money and the selling of animals for sacrifice. So you have to wonder, well, why is Jesus so angry when the Old Testament tells the people to do the very thing that they were doing there? Why was Jesus so upset? Well, what was going on is pilgrims would come to Passover from not just the rest of Israel, but really from all over the rest of the world during this time of year. And they would come to celebrate the historic event of God delivering the Israelites out of Egypt. And it was every year they would commemorate God's deliverance for their people. And one of the things that the temple called for was every male to pay a tax that went towards the upkeep of the temple. Now, the money that it was called for was a certain kind of it was a denarius, a half shekel. And the people didn't carry half shekels around with them. I mean, this would be like a tenth of a penny to you and I. It just wasn't something people carried around commonly. So what they would do is they would bring their money and exchange it, because the temple wouldn't take the currency that everybody was using because it had a picture of Caesar on it. And that was idolatry. So you couldn't take your money with a picture of Caesar on it and offer it at the temple. So they would go there and have these things exchanged. And it would be at an exorbitant price. The other thing that was going on in this, the court of the Gentiles there, is whenever people came, they were supposed to offer a sacrifice for their family. And typically it was a lamb, and one lamb would be sufficient for about 10 people in every family. And the lamb had to be a lamb without blemish. The problem with this was, is let's say you had a good amount of money and you had your own animals. And let's say Mike, who's going to Jerusalem, gets the idea. They rip people off at the temple selling lambs. So Mike says, I've got this beautiful, spotless lamb that would be perfect for this. So Mike says, rather than paying a whole bunch of money, I'm going to bring the lamb with me, which you could do. That was totally fine to be able to do. So Mike brings it there, but the priests and the people there were in charge of inspecting the animals. Now, in order to collect a tax in this area of the world at the time, because the Romans ran everything, the Romans said, if you're going to collect any kind of a tax, you owe us. So for the coins being changed, for commerce that happened in the temple where they were selling in the temple money that would be offered to a god, the Romans got a kickback on that. And the people that they put in charge of overseeing the business of the temple was the high priest's family. So the high priest's family, in essence, sold these franchises to different people for the money changing and the buying and selling of animals. So the high priest would want money for the franchise that they were selling. The Romans would want their kickback. So Mike shows up with his beautiful lamb expecting to be able to use it for sacrifice, and guess what? There's a blemish here. Sorry, Mike. Love to be able to let you use this, but you're going to have to buy one of ours. And fortunately for you, Mike, we have one, right? And because people took worship and they took their offering very seriously, they were basically left with no other option. So there was extortion, corruption at every level going on in there. And this, think about this, this is the place where people went to meet with God, to be with God. It was the one place where people went to celebrate together. And it was being used for a totally immoral, evil purpose. No wonder Jesus walks in there. And it's interesting how he walks in there. He doesn't walk in there as a parishioner who would say, oh, this place, God's place, isn't supposed to be used for this. He calls it my Father's house. And if it belongs to the Father, guess who inherits it? Jesus is saying, this is my place, and you're desecrating my house that I own, and you have no right to be setting up the furniture the way you want to set it up. Especially when it's done in the name of evil, the very kind of evil that I came to stamp out. So So it's no wonder that Jesus was so upset. So if you look in your notes here, just a couple fill in the blanks here. First of all, why? What was the temple used for? Well, it was a place that was set aside where in the Old Testament, God's very presence dwelt in the inner courtyard of that temple building. And the people went there because it was the closest place they could get to actually being near where God was. And of course, they wanted to do that, and they wanted to worship him. And the other thing that was so important that happened there was there was a sacrifice. People knew that they were broken, and that brokenness in their lives and making a mess of the world, something needed to be done about it. And see, one of the neat things about the temple sacrifice system is that God set it up. And he set it up in a way to help the people say, although you live in a broken world and you're partly responsible for the mess of the world, God was making a way for people to make amends for what they had done. And that's why people would come and take something valuable and shed its blood in place of their own blood, so to speak, for the misdeeds that they had done. And people took that really seriously. In the story in Luke chapter 19, just before this, Jesus comes into the house of a guy who was a tax collector. He worked for the Roman government. He had one of those franchises, and he was ripping people off. And Jesus comes to his house, and everybody's shocked that Jesus would go to his house. Because they thought, why would you go to the house of someone that's taken money from us, from our family, from our people? Why would you want to have anything to do with a guy like that? Jesus goes and he meets, this is the gracious Jesus that we love, right? Hey man, no matter what you think of this guy, I'm going to reach out to build a bridge of relationship with this guy. And it's interesting because Zacchaeus, this tax collector, this guy who's ripping people off, he has Jesus in his house. And Zacchaeus, he doesn't pray a prayer. He doesn't say, Lord, forgive me for what I've done. He doesn't get on his knees and beg Jesus to forgive him. He says two simple things. He says, I give half of my possessions away to the poor. He still would have been enormously wealthy, but he says, I give half of my possessions away to the poor. And then he says something shocking. He says, and I'll give four times back to people that I've ripped off. Now that's considering what his job was, that was an enormous amount of money. Now, he didn't just pick the number four times out of thin air and go, well, I've ripped people off, so it'd be nice for me to do something for those people. You know what he's doing? The Old Testament told people that if you took advantage of people and you ripped them off, you, if you were going to be right with them, to make restitution, you didn't just pay them back, but you would pay them back four times. So what's Zacchaeus doing? He's not praying a prayer, oh, Jesus, forgive me. He's not getting on his knees, oh, forgive me. He's doing what was required to be right with other people. And Jesus says to him this shocking statement, today salvation has come to this house. It's not because he prays a prayer. It's not because he says, I'll memorize 50 Bible verses, Jesus. It's not because he grovels for forgiveness. It's because he sought restitution for what he knew he had done wrong. See, you guys know the story about Bernie Madoff, the Wall Street billionaire who ripped people off to the tune of $20 billion, with a B, billion dollars. And a number of people, it was their life savings that he ripped off. Now, if you're one of those people, would you invite Bernie Madoff to come to your family vacation trip that you're going on, or come to your Thanksgiving dinner, or whatever it is you gather together as a joyous celebration? Bernie, I know you ripped us off, but it's cool. Come hang out with us. You might do that looking for the opportunity to push him out of the balcony, right? but you're not excited. You would not be excited. It would certainly be uncomfortable having that person that ripped you off in your home because he's done something horrible, taking advantage of you. And if there's any hope of really restoring that relationship, man, oh man, it would be nice if Bernie did something for restitution to pay back what he did wrong. Not just call or write a letter and say, hey, I'm sorry. It seems like small potatoes in the midst of what he did. See, God takes restitution for sin seriously. so seriously that someone has to pay a payment for sin in the world. And see, this is why when we ask God to forgive us, and you think that you're just asking and it's free, it doesn't cost you anything, you have to realize God's wrath, his anger, is satisfied because it was poured out on Jesus in your place. And so you can either accept the payment that God offers because Jesus suffered for you, or you can say, no, God, that's okay. I'll take care of it myself. And there is no way to make right what you did wrong, because you know what? You're not the person that Bernie Madoff ripped off. You and I are Bernie Madoff, and we've ripped God off. See, we don't think of it like that, but that's the picture the Bible paints. God gave us life, wealth, ability, all of this stuff to make a mark in the world for him, to represent him well. And you know what we end up doing? We use all of that stuff to make a name, but not for him, but for ourselves. We are the Bernie Madoffs. We are the ones who need forgiveness, because we're the ones that have ripped God off. Why was Jesus so angry? Well, besides from what I just told you, the other issue that's going on here is the insiders, the Jewish people, this was their building, right? This was sort of their place. And there was one spot reserved for people who weren't ethnically Jewish to come and worship, and that was that court. And the very place that those people, the outsiders, were supposed to come and be able to enjoy the presence of God and worship and celebrate him, the insiders were saying, we've got our spot, and we need a spot to do this business, so we'll take your spot. And to make matters worse, not only was there commerce being done in that court of the Gentiles, remember how I showed you how close it was to the Mount of Olives? So because people are coming and going, guess what they used as their shortcut, their thoroughfare? It was convenient to walk through there and parade through there. So the way people went back and forth, it would have been more inconvenient to go out the other wall or through the other gates. But because that was just convenient, that's where they would parade back and forth through, taking advantage of that space. And in so doing, what they were doing is the people that knew God, right? They knew him and they understood who he was and what he was all about. You know what they were doing? They were making it difficult for other people to have access to him. Do you ever wonder in your life, like if you feel like you've got you know God and you're in with him, you might feel like you're an insider because you grew up in the church or you've been a Christian for a long time. You ever wonder, is it possible that for convenience sake or for whatever, because you're doing what you want to do in life, that other people are seeing what you're doing and they're going, if that's what God is all about, I don't really want to have anything to do with him. Is it possible that if you and I are insiders, there's times in our lives where we do things that misrepresent what God is all about, and in doing that, we're impeding, we're blocking the path for people to come to God? The other thing that's going on here is obviously there's this space, and can you imagine going, like let's say you go to San Francisco to watch the Nutcracker during Christmas, right? And you go in there and, you know, you go through commercialization all the way there, but one of the things that's nice is you get to sit, you know, in this auditorium, and it's beautiful, and there's this beautiful thing going on up there on the stage. Can you imagine going to the Nutcracker, right? And you're watching the performance up there, and in the back, all of a sudden, a big neon sign comes on for a restaurant right down the street, saying, "After the show, come visit." Can you imagine how distracting that would be, right? You understand that there's just like that's not the place for commercialization, right? Yeah, it's not supposed. That's not what that place is for. God set us. He wanted to set aside a place just for people to be able to enjoy God. You know, one of the biggest crimes that I'm guilty of as a pastor. And I'm not asking for volunteers because there's plenty of you that have plenty of things to say. It's a rhetorical question. I get up here and I think my job is to talk and to give you information. And you know what I think people need more than anything else in life today? And it really, it probably, if I could have the guts to do it, it'd probably be the most beneficial thing I could do right now. I've said enough. And just to give you 5 minutes in here in dark and silence, just to sit and think and meditate and think about who God is and what it means to follow him. But as a pastor, we're always so inclined to teach, tell, go, that we think that's the most important thing, rather than figuring out how to create a space where people can come in here and just encounter God. And worship is good and it's great. But you know, one of the things that makes people most uncomfortable is in that transition from when the band is done doing worship up here, they're getting off the stage and whoever's speaking comes up here. And one of the things that they teach you in performance arts is unless the transition time has a meaningful purpose and you're trying to create a mood, don't let it be quiet because it makes people uncomfortable, right? Because people have this expectation to go, 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 do, 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 here, listen, listen. I think one of the most beneficial things we could do is just stop. And I'm not going to do that right now for you. These people, you know what they were doing is God's just, it's moral evil for people to use their power to gain more power. And that's exactly what's going on here. The wealthy people that already had economic means in the world were just using it to further themselves and their own lives and agendas. The last thing, I don't know how I did that. The last thing I told you about the insiders and the outsiders and obstructing people and their access to God. Well, I think a good question is just, the temple's not around today. I think it is worth asking ourselves, just in light of the way Jesus says, take me and what it means to follow me seriously. And when you disregard me, it's not like it's just okay. God's wrath will be satisfied. It will be poured on. And so I think it's worth asking ourselves, well, in light of this, and for our own lives and our own time, how do we respond to this message? And there's two simple things. And the first one is, remember, before Jesus goes in and he clears out the temple, he's going into Jerusalem. He's going into the temple, which he says, this is my place. This is my house. And the people at that moment, they were exuberant and excited. They were thrilled that he was coming. They felt like the king was coming home, and they welcomed him in. And you know, I think everybody needs to have a starting place in their life and their relationship with God. We all need that. We all need that Palm Sunday where we say, the king, come, because the temple isn't there. He's not coming home to the temple, but he does. See, here's the thing. After the temple was gone, God still has a place in the world. And you know where he inhabits now? The Holy Spirit. It dwells in us. That's the promise that God made. Jesus says, I'm going away, but I'll send a helper to be with you forever. See, it's not like God's abandoned us. We are his temple, and everybody should have a moment in their life where they recognize who he is. And you welcome him in. You receive him with gladness and joy, recognizing that forgiveness is available, that the wholeness of life as God meant it to be can be realized. All of us need a Palm Sunday. We all need that. We all need that. That's one of the great things. See, you don't have to grovel. You don't have to stand up and go, yes, I'll do that. If you want to do that, raise your hand right now and say, yes, that's me. I need that. I want to do that. That's great. But you don't even have to do that. You want to come up after the service and talk to somebody up here. You want to talk to me or somebody? We'd love to do that. But you know, that's a good thing to do to confirm your commitment. But you know what? Just right where you are, or tonight when you're at home, getting ready to go to bed, eat dinner, whatever, wherever you are, there is no religious thing to do to welcome him in. All you got to do is just say, you know what, God, I'm tired of playing games, and I know you're the king, and I know I need you in. Come in. We all need that moment. We all need to have a time where we deliberately and intentionally invite Jesus in. And the second one is, you know, if while you're out from your house right now, and let's say you have a guest that's staying at your house but said, I don't want to go to church this morning. If you came home and they had rearranged the furniture, you might not be happy. See, I had this experience this last week, I come home, and not a guest, but my wife has totally redone our living room kitchen area. Totally redone it. And the reality is I'm the guest in the house because she's there most of the time anyways. And I've just learned my wife enjoys changing, moving things around anyway. So it's just, you know, after the first couple times, I just expected, oh, this is how it's going to be. A house is going to be different. And I, rather than being stressed out about it, I've learned to enjoy it. So I come home and the house has been redone. See, and that's okay because it's her house. And in a real sense, I am. I'm just the guest there, in there. So it's okay. If I was the one that rearranged the stuff, and she's in there more than me with the kids, it would be intrusive because it's more their space than mine because they spend far more time there than I do. And think of it even more so if you have a guest that's at your house right now, didn't want to come to church this morning, and you come home and your house is totally redone. Or worse, let's say they wanted to sell your stuff for commercial purposes for themselves, you probably wouldn't be happy because it's not their house. It's yours. The only person that has the right to rearrange the furniture is the person that owns the house. If Jesus you've invited him in, he's not supposed to be a guest. It's supposed to be his house. And you might ask yourself, where do I see that Jesus is, if he needs to, he ask him to flip over the tables. Ask him to rearrange the furniture. Because Jesus doesn't want to come in. He won't put up with being a house guest. He's God. He didn't put up with people coming in and doing whatever they wanted with the temple because it was his. And you know what? You and I, we belong to God. And just like the temple, he gave them, you have the privilege to do what you want with this space. And the people misused it. And boy, oh boy, did they pay for that. You and I, we've got our lives. God's given us this autonomy to do what we want with it. But we make no mistake, you and I, we belong to him. We belong to him. And if you've invited him in, allow him to rearrange the furniture. God, thanks for thanks that you in all of the stories we have, we only have one where we saw this wrath come out. But it does call the heated attention to it. There will be a day when we will stand before you, and it can either be a joyous, a really exciting day that we look forward to, or it might be a really painful, difficult day. And you give us the choice. You give us this. You give us a choice to invite you in and allow you to make the space yours, or we can go on our own. God, give this week. Help us to just take pause, because it really is. Easter week is sort of it's a gift for us to think about your death and what you did for us and the payment you made for us, and giving us the opportunity to reflect on what it means to really genuinely invite you in. Help us to take advantage of the moment you've given us. Because of your goodness and your grace and all that it means to know you and love you and be forgiven by you, we thank you. And it's always in your Son's name that we do this. Amen.